Reed and his crew on the VIP list. They waited a few minutes before a gamine woman bounded down the steps of the club. She leaned over the rail and hugged Pete. She had been raised in Soundview and had a job as a searcher, looking for weapons before clubgoers were granted entry. Pete handed her a gift bag. It contained 5 loaded handguns, which she took inside. Sex, money, murder swept through, pausing to be lightly searched in a vestibule before following Pete into the packed heart of the club. The long, vaulted ceiling of the main room ran over railroad tracks sunken into the dance floor. Rap boomed around the brick walls of the former freight depot. Housing projects from all 5 boroughs were represented, and young men, some on ecstasy, scanned the room for rival crews. Scantily clad young women, glistening with sweat and sexuality, ground and bumped to the beat. Pete led his vanguard through the throng, past the bar and up the stairs to unisex bathrooms near the VIP room. The girl from Soundview arrived with the Christmas bag Pete had given her and handed it over in a bathroom stall. "Don't start any trouble," she said. Pete distributed the weapons. They moved back downstairs to the picture section, where partiers could have themselves photographed. There they sloughed off their leather jackets like boxers about to enter the ring, revealing coils of gold chains. The rap thumping out of the club's sound system offered a narrative that glorified them. Pipe, now fully grown, stood only 5'7". Pete and the others were not that much taller. Pipe slid off his jacket to reveal a diamond-encrusted globe suspended from a gold chain inscribed with the legend, "The World Is Yours," from Scarface. Pete had given it to Pipe after a trip to G&G's jewelry store on Southern Boulevard, a staple of ascendant Bronx gangsters. One day he was having diamonds installed in his Rolex when he decided to buy Twin the $15,000 chain. Twin, unlike Pete, disliked gaudy jewelry and refused the gift. Pete offered it to Pipe instead. Pipe headed for the bar. It had become a pre-club ritual for Pete to dictate how many $90 bottles of Cristal champagne each of them had to buy. Pipe was ordered to buy 10. Twin had to buy 20 because he was making more money. B-Love and the others had to get 15 each. Earlier that night, Pete had pulled out $5,000 and distributed the money to anyone who needed it. Pipe handed over a stack of bills, and the champagne came back on busboy trays. Amid the pop of champagne corks, Pete poured himself a glass, but not a drop would pass his lips. He disdained alcohol. Many of the boys were still too young to drink and, in private, preferred the taste of soda. They shifted their weight from foot to foot, pouring champagne for a pool of stunning young women. As Pipe remembers it, Pete had caught sight of Puff Daddy in the VIP section. He dispatched Pipe as emissary. Pushing upstairs, Pipe slipped through the velvet ropes and made to approach Puff before he was stopped by a giant bodyguard. This was Anthony Wolf Johnson, an old friend of Pete's father. 2 years before, in 1991, he had been convicted of the attempted murder of a New York cop and had recently been released from prison upstate. "Easy," said Wolf. Puff Daddy ordered him to back off. "He's family." Pipe strode up to Puff, who was seated like an emperor among his entourage. "Yo, what up, Puff?" said Pipe. "Pete over there, he wants to see you." Puff Daddy stood up and followed. Puff's deference to Pete was affirmation that sex, money, murder had arrived. In the picture section, Puff strode over and gave Pete a hug and a slap on the back. The two men exchanged a few words. Then Pete added in mild admonishment, "Yo, and this is my family." Puff didn't skip a beat. He gave each of the crew a pound on the back, too, before he returned to the VIP room. By 1:30 a.m., the partiers who worked regular jobs had left the club, and hardcore drug dealers and rappers, with some of the most gorgeous women Pipe had ever seen, took over. After a few hours, Pipe returned to the bar for more champagne. The dance floor behind them heaved like a roiling sea. Pipe bumped up against a diminutive member of Sex, Money, Murder, weighed down with gold jewelry, who in turn pressed up against an imperious man in his mid-20s with doe eyes and a mustache. The man turned around angrily and made a few threats. Pipe clutched a half-empty champagne bottle. When he made another remark, Pipe swung the bottle down on his head. He staggered. Pipe and the crew member scurried back to the others seated in the picture section. About 20 minutes later, the man, flanked by several giant bouncers, fanned out across the room asking questions. Someone, they said, had hit Nas, one of the biggest emerging hip-hop stars, over the head with a bottle. "Oh, shit," Pipe said to Twin. "I ain't know who he was." Minutes later, Nas appeared with the bouncers clutching a bloodied towel to his head. He moved up to where Pipe was sitting, huddled with Sex Money Murder. He took in the glowering crew, braced for a fight, and gazed at Pipe with contempt. Pete leaned forward. Nas locked eyes with Pipe. And then abruptly, Nas averted his gaze. The bouncers asked him something, and, still looking at Pipe, he shook his head. He later identified another man who was immediately ejected. The scene, according to Pipe, demonstrated Sex Money Murder's growing power. They closed out the club at 4 a.m. Outside, the block was thronged with Range Rovers and Mercedeses, trunk fitted with bass speakers that rumbled and made the streets vibrate. Soon, Sex Money Murder joined the honking gridlock of polished luxury and headed wearily home. In 1993, New York City polarized as the number of homicides dropped in the wealthy enclaves of Manhattan, but rose in poorer neighborhoods, including the Bronx public housing projects. The city had 75 precincts at the time, and 43.6% of New York's killings took place in just 12 of them. As Sex Money Murder grew in power, Soundview and the 43rd Precinct became one of the deadliest parts of the city, with a high of 69 murders. Forselli drove to work, avoiding certain exits on the Major Deegan because of the army of squeegee men who hassled drivers and who could drag him into a confrontation before his shift had even started. Early in the evening of June 3, 1993, Forselli, who had been working undercover dressed in a sanitation worker's uniform, raced to 535 Halfmire Avenue. A running gun battle between rival drug dealers had scattered spent 9mm and .380 casings across a pathway leading to the building's back entrance. At 7:09 p.m., a hooded man had emerged from the back entrance of 535, blazing at another man who returned fire as he fell. 7-year-old Joseph Washington, playing nearby with Edwin Stewart, a friend of the same age, tumbled to the ground. With an outstretched arm, he beseeched Edwin for help. But seconds later, Edwin screamed as bullets ripped into his back. Edwin's 33-year-old father heard gunshots and ran to the playground to find his son had been hit in the spine. When ambulances failed to arrive, a police officer rushed them to Jacoby Hospital. Joseph lost so much blood from wounds to his esophagus and aorta that he died shortly after arrival. The intended victim of the shooting, a rival dealer, died on the operating table with 4 gunshot wounds. Edwin Stewart was swept into emergency surgery. A bullet was removed from his spine. For years to come, he would suffer the loss of bowel control and endure nightmares from which he awoke screaming. Both boys were linked to police families. Forselli, still dressed in the sanitation uniform, slipped into the crowd of residents. Repeatedly, he heard the word veneno, Spanish for poison. Forselli knew that a fearsome local drug supplier, Rafael Poison Agosto, was closely tied to the Mullins twins and Sex Money Murder. With daylight dwindling, Forselli drove to the parking lot behind 535 Halfmire. Conspicuously parked among the older, broken-down cars was a luxury green Jaguar, Poison's car. Forselli slashed the Jag's tires before reversing his car and parking it on the street. He and other officers entered 535 and worked their way down from the top through every single one of the building's 157 apartments. Many residents were hostile, while others simply refused to answer the door. When they reached the bottom, the officers noted the numbers of apartments from which there was no answer. Forselli checked out these apartments a second time, getting down on his hands and knees to look under their doors. In 3H, he saw feet pacing back and forth and heard voices speaking in urgent, hushed tones. He suspected he had his man. Poison, it turned out, was locked inside with his mother and the twins. A situation escalated into a barricade. The suspects refused to come out. A SWAT team and hostage negotiators worked through the night as Forselli waited in the stairwell. Agosto's mother called her boss, a Bronx councilwoman, and asked her to contact the police, demanding that they stop harassing her innocent son. The councilwoman called the police brass and Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer. Eventually the three men gave themselves up. By 3:40 p.m. the following day they had been taken to the 43rd Precinct. Poison was charged with the murder of Abraham Smith, the man who had returned fire, and Joseph Washington, along with assault in the first degree on his playmate, Edwin Stewart. After the shooting, detectives canvassed 2,000 homes in Castle Hill for witnesses, but few would volunteer information. A 911 call from the projects identified the shooter as Puerto Rican, but the caller would not identify herself. "It needs to stop. My mother is outside with my three little nieces," said the anonymous source. Finally, a few women, devout churchgoers who initially refused to bear witness because of perceived threats against them, were forced to swear on the Bible to what they had seen. Finally, they tendered the truth before agreeing to testify. Another, Nancy Rosa, was ordered to testify due to a material witness order, a tort that compels anyone with information to testify. Before the trial, she and her entire family were relocated from the Castle Hill projects because her acting as a prosecution witness might cost them their lives. Agosto would get 50 years, and Forselli was promoted to detective for his part in the case. Out on patrol, the single Cop Killer from Body Count, led by the rapper Ice-T, or NWA's Fuck the Police, seeped out of the open windows of the projects and drifted from powerful stereos in cars like the Suzuki Samurai that Forselli often saw in Edenwald. A couple of years earlier, Forselli had answered an urgent call in Eastchester Heights, where he found Hector Fontanez, a 26-year-old police officer, dying as he was lifted up by other cops, his bulletproof vest torn to ribbons and dripping with blood. He had been shot in the back and stomach by a 21-year-old with a .357 Magnum. Sometimes kids would shout out the lyrics of Cop Killer at Forselli from across the street. If he ignored them, it got worse the next time he passed, so invariably he confronted them and let them know he was watching them. As the summer of 1993 unfolded, Pete's bond with Twin intensified. They were pushing cocaine out through their networks. Twin bought wholesale from Pete to distribute in Castle Hill and Kingston. They split the profits evenly. While Twin was making his own moves, Pete developed his Pittsburgh connection with Cod. By 1994, when the first Manhattan Starbucks opened on the Upper West Side, the drug business had already similarly shifted from a monolithic corporate model, too easily targeted by police, to a franchise model. Twin and Pete were both making money from various out-of-town arrangements, sometimes with each other and sometimes independently. In their downtime, the two spent hours in strip clubs in Hunts Point and brought the strippers back to Soundview for orgies. One morning in mid-August, they went to Harlem Week, a celebration of black culture. The sidewalks teemed with sizzling food, music pounded out of hastily erected stages, and souped-up cars prowled with aspiring gangsters at the wheel. Twin sat down on some old crates to play dice with a local stick-up kid, Kenyon Cato Jenkins, on the corner of West 126th Street and 7th Avenue. Pete sat idly in his car, half watching the dice game but more interested in the women walking by. At around 11 a.m., Twin and Cato got into a heated discussion about money owed on a dice roll. Cato pulled up his shirt to reveal a handgun in his waistband. Pete, who knew that Twin was unarmed, got out of the car, circling around behind Cato undetected. He flashed a grin at Twin and calmly delivered a point-blank shot to the back of Cato's head, killing him instantly. He and Twin got in the car and drove back to Soundview. A few days later, outside 551, Pete explained the murder to Pipe. "Nigga tried to front on Twin," he said. "I had to pop the nigga's head off." He paused. "I took a body to protect my man." Because of Cato's carelessness, it was easy to shoot him, Pete indicated, and therefore Cato had invited his own destruction because he should have known better. "I caught that nigga slipping," said Pete. For Pipe, there was no demonstration of greater love than killing another man to protect your friend. Pete, though, rather than keeping the murder secret, advertised it to burnish his reputation. Most people in the neighborhood assumed that he had already caught a body, so Pete didn't mention that this was his first. On the street, the murder of Cato signaled a small vassal state switching to a war footing. Pete grew paranoid and insisted that everyone carry a gun at all times in case there was retaliation from Harlem. He ditched his .38 revolver for a .45 semi-automatic. He started advising everyone to shoot to the head. Only Pipe and those closest to Pete noticed a change in their old friend after the killing. Pete would still joke like a teenager about kids on the block with smelly feet or poor personal hygiene. He still filled the role of the dashing playboy. But Pipe could see that he was transformed. The murder had made him afraid, and in his fear he became preoccupied with strategy and violence. It now took little for him to lose his temper. One day Pipe heard a commotion on the block, shouting and what sounded like a dog barking and growling. He ran toward the sound and saw Roe restraining a 3-year-old fawn-colored pit bull that pawed at the ground, gnashing its teeth and lunging at Pete. Roe egged the dog on, laughing, as Pete jumped back in horror. Roe rescued pit bulls that were abandoned by dog-fighting rings in Soundview Park. He kept 3 dogs in his apartment. Pete disliked the breed, swearing that they couldn't be trusted. Roe continued to taunt Pete. "Yeah, get him, boy!" The dog reared again. This time Pete lost his temper, warning that if Roe didn't stop, he would shoot the dog. Roe carried on. A single pop split the air. When the dog had kept coming at him, Pete had shot it in the head. Roe crouched over the dead animal's form, and distraught, broke down in tears. When a neighborhood kid came up and started to laugh at the toughened gangster's vulnerability, Roe jumped up and stabbed him twice in the belly. As news of Pete's murder of Cato spread, other reports circulated that a gangster in the Monroe Projects was snitching on him for the killing. On a hazy September evening, Pete, Twin, and Pipe pedaled BMX bikes around the projects to relax, hoodies laced up around their faces. At around 11 p.m., opposite the Monroe Projects, they saw the man who had supposedly snitched alighting from a double-parked blue Honda Acura. Music blared from the car's interior as he headed to a payphone. The boys took cover behind a corner. "I'ma rock him right here," said Pete. Twin argued that he should be the one to do it, as Pete had shot Cato on his behalf. The two squabbled for several minutes. They decided that Twin would sneak up on foot while Pete shadowed him on the bicycle. Pete got close enough to raise his gun to the man's head, but the gun jammed. The man took off, and Pete followed on the bike, firing a .45 one-handed as he rode. Some armed drug dealers standing out front thought that the attack was against them. They had recently robbed some Colombians of their cocaine and were jittery, expecting retaliation. Their first shot blew Pete's baseball hat off, and the second flung him from the saddle of the bicycle and into the road. His bulletproof vest saved him. He clambered back on and rode into the darkness. Pipe stole the suspected snitch's Acura and sped around the projects in search of him. Twin ran into the building, following Pete. A few minutes later, Pipe, hunched behind the wheel, saw a figure cycling away, clearly injured. It was Pete, fleeing for the safety of Soundview. Pete turned, recognized the car, and assumed that he was being run down by his victim. He aimed the gun at the car. "Yo, it's me!" shouted Pipe out the window, ducking as he pulled alongside. I'm hit, Pete said over and over, his breathing labored. Pipes saw two jagged holes in the fabric of his hoodie. They hobbled back to 551. Pete winced as he pulled off the bulletproof vest. Two bruises on his chest mushroomed into yellow badges. The old Santero had told him that jail or death would come for him. Pete saw surviving the shooting as a sign of his invincibility. By autumn, Soundview had evolved into a fortress. The police rarely went in on foot patrol, leaving sex money murder with absolute dominion. A few weeks after the shooting in the Monroe Projects, Pete and Pipe were on the eastern side of the projects near Cozy Corner. Both were armed, as was now customary. At 1 a.m., they were startled by an unmarked blue van pulling up alongside them. Inside were plainclothes detectives, clearly visible through untinted glass. "Those motherfuckers," said Pete. He pulled out the Tech 9 and pointed it at the van. The cops ducked, giving Pete and Pipe time to sprint off into the night. Pipe was angry at Pete for putting them needlessly at risk. "I wasn't going to shoot them niggas, man," Pete reasoned. "I just wanted to scare 'em up." 3 days later, Whitey, a neighborhood kid who had become a loose affiliate, was sent across the road from 551 to the bodega to buy a cigar. He was stopped by undercover detectives who rolled up on him in an unmarked police car and caught him with drugs. "Yo, fuck it," said Pete as they watched the police surround him. "We can't let them get away with that." Pete, Pipe, and a few others piled into the elevator, sprinted across the roof to the edge, pulling out their guns as they ran. "On the count of three," said Pete. They looked down like mountain partisans ambushing a convoy of soldiers in a ravine. Pipe inhaled and pointed his gun to the sky and fired. In the shower of bullets, Pipe saw that Pete was the only one actually shooting at the police. "What the fuck?" shouted Pipe over the shooting. "You is crazy, a lunatic, man!" Down below, the police scattered. Some dropped their guns. Radios skidded across the sidewalk. The boys sprinted down the steps of 551 and up the stairwell at 541 to Stymie's apartment. Stymie was the man who was nearly murdered with Fat Mike. After scrubbing their hands with alcohol and orange juice, which they'd heard might remove the smell of gunpowder, they left their weapons and congregated outside 1710, Beelove's building. 20 police officers, with guns drawn, spread over the area. A few officers searched the roof, examining spent bullet casings. Others moved up on Pete, Pipe, and their friends, demanding IDs. They obliged, showing their fake licenses, and the police moved on. When Pete turned 19, Cod bought him a brand-new jet-black Mazda RX-7 worth around $50,000. Pete brought it to Pipe to show off the modifications, a stash box and a rear windscreen with a bank of high-intensity halogen lights that could momentarily blind pursuers, and, in homage to James Bond, a revolving license plate. Though Pete had been warned that narcotics detectives had started slipping into Mecca to listen in on the deals there, he was intent on going into the city for a meeting with Puff Daddy. Pete was determined to press Puff to sign two Soundview rappers, Lord Tariq and Peter Guns, to the Bad Boy label, and Puff had agreed to discuss it. According to Pipe, knowing better than to refuse a request from Pistol Pete, Puff was on the verge of agreeing, and unbeknownst to Puff, Pete left the meeting with a plan to launder money through the record business. They drove north back to the Bronx at around 4:30 a.m. On the Bruckner Expressway, another driver kept boxing them into their lane. Pete told Pipe to roll down the passenger window. Pete pulled a 9mm from the stash box while guiding the car in behind. Pipe, petrified, tilted his seat back, gripping the sides and moving his head to one side. Pete tried to get a shot off as the gun traced erratic circles in front of Pipe's nose, but the driver in front continued to block them in as the two cars weaved all over the road. Pete slid open the sunroof. When the man pulled in front of him, Pete stuck his hand up through the roof and laid down a haphazard volley of shots at the back of the car, emptying a 15-round magazine. The bullets tore into the back of the vehicle before it fishtailed and caromed off a concrete wall. Pete sped on without looking back. The blue lights of a patrol car flashed behind them in the distance. Cod had outfitted the car with another modification, a switch that killed the brake lights, so the police couldn't judge when Pete was accelerating or decelerating. He slowed for a red light and was clipped by another car, lost control, ground to a halt, and then smashed the car into reverse before speeding off again, this time to a house in Queens. In November, Twin suggested a football game between rival projects, a chance for them to set down their guns and compete as athletes. And so, in the fall of 1993, the Turkey Bowl was born. On the field, egos came to the fore. Pete was nimble and flashy, while Twin was more of a bruiser. Pipe ended up on Twin's team that first year, despite his affiliation with Soundview. Pipe, weighing only a little over 100 pounds, was flattened by Pete repeatedly. But that was nothing compared to when Bear, well over 200 pounds and 6'5", went airborne and crushed Pipe like a paper bag under the wheel of a truck. Bleeding and bruised, Pipe took it all in good cheer. When the game started to favor Castle Hill, he was switched back to the Soundview team. Stymie became the focus of everyone's tackles and was slammed to the ground repeatedly. No one could forget that he had testified in the triple homicide case involving Fat Mike. People started to call him the Black Cat, because those associated with him either ended up dead or in prison. When Soundview pulled ahead, Twin cursed his team. "You niggas suck dick, man. I'm doing all the work out here." Soundview won, 28-21. Afterward, they all drove to Red Lobster. 16-year-old Pipe looked around the table at his friends' bruised and scraped faces, happier than he'd ever seen them. They vowed to make the game a tradition. 6. Justice. After the Cowboys case, O'Malley returned to his post at Bronx Homicide, but there was one unresolved piece of the case that continued to irk him. In countless proffers, he'd heard about the underworld hitman Justice Brown, a key member of the crew, yet he was still evading O'Malley and on the run. O'Malley asked his lieutenant for permission to pursue Justice when he wasn't working on other cases. He went on NBC's Prime Suspect with Mike Hegedus, seeking information on his whereabouts. And at night, he visited every Manhattan precinct, asking them to put up wanted posters of Justice near the cells. Eventually, he got a break. A call came from the 32nd Precinct. A defendant facing serious time on a gun charge and hoping to cut a deal told O'Malley that a man fitting Justice's description had appeared at his brother's house in Brooklyn. A few days later, in November 1993, O'Malley and Detective Hector Beecham, then his partner, parked outside 2132A Fulton Street, a nondescript three-story brick house. A man whose face was obscured by a tightly cinched hoodie and steel-rimmed glasses emerged early in the afternoon. If they jumped the wrong person, he'd raise the alarm and Justice would slip the net once again. "Fuck it," said O'Malley. "We gotta take him." Beecham raced up the street past the suspect, made a U-turn, and then crashed up on the sidewalk as if they were going to run him down. O'Malley jumped out, gun drawn. He bluffed that he was looking for Tyrone Green, a randomly chosen name, using it as a ruse to calm Justice into thinking he would be released at the precinct. They took him to the 83rd. In the cell, he removed his hoodie, and O'Malley realized that he had collared the right man. Beneath a wiry beard, a smile played on Justice's lips. "You guys were good," he said, "but you know if I was strapping, one of us wouldn't be here today." During booking, he learned that he was to be taken to the Metropolitan Correctional Center to face federal charges. He turned to O'Malley. "I guess I'm going to meet Ms. Glazer, aren't I?" Glazer had become the scourge of Bronx gangs, her reputation spreading across interconnected crews in the city. 2 weeks after Justice's arrest, she called O'Malley with the extraordinary news that Justice was willing to flip. At first, they thought he'd be of little use, but ultimately he confessed to 5 murders. In some of the killings, he had fired the same gun that Derek Augustine had used to kill Stephen Palmer, and he admitted to the murder of David Torres back on March 9, 1991, another cold case. Glazer watched O'Malley develop a relationship with justice. She saw how he was able to extract a narrative that revealed the complex dynamics of overlapping street crews, the estrangements, the retaliation cycles, and the politics of the street. It was difficult work, requiring a feel for street life and the ability to spot a lie in the same way a conductor could hear an off note from an orchestra. In March 1994, O'Malley fed a single sheet of paper into his typewriter at Bronx Homicide and listed a staggering 31 murders that had finally been solved with the closure of the Cowboys Crew case, along with Justice's proffers. Glazer and O'Malley were amazed. As Glazer had listened to O'Malley and Justice work, she saw a whole new landscape of crime, one she recognized as more destructive and more insidious than the mafia, the street crews driving New York's homicide rates. Glazer was dismayed at the resources being poured into the war against the mafia when the real reason behind New York's murder rate was the street killings by neighborhood crews. Meanwhile, the feds focused on the glory of mafia cases, something she derided as boy food. The Eastern District of New York, whose jurisdiction encompassed Queens and Brooklyn, took on the mafia on their home turf, but they did few street gang cases because their prosecutors were fed cases by an FBI largely obsessed with Italian organized crime. The Manhattan office of the FBI had also won abundant resources to tackle the five families. In 1991, Glazer noted, the Colombo crime family had been tearing itself apart. 10 people were murdered over a one-year period, garnering lurid headlines and countless articles. During that same time in the Bronx, however, 3 times that number were killed in a 3-block area in Hunts Point, the corner of Seneca and Bryant Avenues, controlled by 3 warring crack gangs who sold drugs from a hole in the wall. Not one of those killings received significant media coverage. The success she enjoyed with O'Malley had shown Glazer that they could reduce the bloodshed in New York if they could apply RICO to street crews. The Justice Department was reluctant to use RICO laws for what some staffers called Bronx mutts. Was it a dangerous precedent to set? If they used RICO laws on street crews, could they be applied to stockbrokers, for example? Senior officials were skeptical that the drug crews were enterprises, like the mafia. RICO had been deployed against the drug crews in Harlem in the 1980s, but Glazer's pivot would be to use the statutes to also go after murder and violence, rarely prosecuted in federal courts. Meanwhile, O'Malley built his skills through trial and error. 2 months into the proffer sessions with Justice, the hitman got word to Glazer and O'Malley that his conscience troubled him. "I lied," he admitted flatly. Earlier, he had told them about a Baltimore murder he had been involved in, claiming he had been the getaway driver. "Chicky ordered the hit," he said, and admitted that he had been the actual shooter. "What did we tell you about telling the truth?" scolded Glazer. The office was divided as to whether to keep using him. The standard in a case like this, when a source had lied, was to tear up the cooperation agreement and have him face down a judge with all of his guilty pleas. Justice realized the seriousness of his position. Ultimately, Glazer made him plead to the murder and perjury. O'Malley used the experience to press cooperators more deeply when he suspected the slightest trace of untruthfulness in proffer sessions. They continued to use Justice to solve more cases. Most importantly, and this O'Malley never expected, he began to talk about Chicky Rosario. Rosario had been captured in 1989 after a shootout with police on the Harlem River Drive. His driver had agreed to give testimony before a grand jury. 3 months later, the driver turned up dead, with 5 bullets in the back of his head. Another crew member flipped and told a story of how Rosario got hit by a stray bullet on 145th Street and declared to one of his lieutenants, "This is the Emperor. No one shoots the Emperor." Rosario found the names of his assailants, and he and another man went and shot them dead at a roller rink in the Bronx. He was given 40 years and sent to the Great Meadow Correctional Facility. Before long, he was controlling it from the inside. The Southern District had decided to prosecute him federally, largely because he was still too powerful, even inside prison. As the investigation got underway, O'Malley visited Chickie's wife in the Bronx. While there, he was handed the telephone. On the other end was Chickie, calling from a cell phone in prison. "Get the fuck out of my house." When the federal indictment was unsealed, O'Malley drove to Great Meadow with Detective Billy Relott. Rosario, shuffling out in shackles, looked at the two officers and said, "You're O'Malley, homicide, and you're Relott, narcotics." On the drive down, the two detectives chatted with the emperor and tested his potential to flip now that he faced life in the federal system. On that suggestion, Chickie's manner abruptly changed. "Go fuck yourself," he said. He later went to trial, and O'Malley's star cooperator, Justice, helped send him away for life. After her experience with O'Malley, Glazer saw building a relationship with the NYPD, not solely the FBI, as the key to her new initiative. After a ship called the Golden Venture ran aground in Rockaway Beach, Queens, with 286 illegal immigrants from China aboard, she began building a RICO case with the NYPD against the Chinese smugglers. The FBI's New York director was furious that the agency was circumvented, but Glazer saw the value of the NYPD's expertise. As more potential cases came in, Glazer realized not only that the NYPD could provide crucial help, but also that every precinct had detectives who knew the names of all the major players in the neighborhood and understood the hierarchies and their interrelationships. They simply didn't have the power to stop them. Glazer needed these detectives to feed her with RICO cases to begin chipping away at the murder rate. She'd be circumventing the FBI again, which could cause some damaged egos, but she felt it was worth the risk. She set up a meeting at One Police Plaza with all the borough commanders. The detectives sat stone-faced as she tried to convince them to use her prosecutors and the RICO laws to attack the drug crews. The more hard-bitten cops saw federal prosecutors as spoiled Ivy League brats who just wanted to play tough for a few years before going into securities enforcement, and then a sinecure in a Wall Street firm. The feds stole their cases, took all the glory for themselves, and refused to give them information in return. And most cops knew that circumventing the Bronx DA could get them fired. Glazer later called the meeting a disaster. Still, she pressed on with her agenda. Back in October 1993, a few weeks before she and O'Malley had arrested Justice, the newspapers announced the indictment of a Mott Haven gang called C&C. Gang bosses George Calderon and Angel Padilla had control of the area, setting up headquarters at 550 East 139th Street, a five-story tenement at a busy intersection. They turned the basement into a dungeon, where they raped a girl on a workbench before murdering her, and cut the ears off a drug dealer with a hacksaw before shooting him in the head and leaving him at the Harlem River rail yards. They rented out squares of sidewalk to neighborhood hustlers at $800 per week to those selling crack. Heroin dealers were charged $500 per week, on the condition that they sell Calderon and Padilla's brand. NYPD Detective Bobby Adalorado helped build the case on the suspicion that at least 80 murders could be attributed to C&C. After Padilla was arrested in September 1992, the homicide rate in Mott Haven, one of the poorest areas in the nation, dropped to zero that month, according to statistics from Adalorado and Glazer. Even better, Adalorado had managed to flip a cousin of one of the main crew members who had given up the whole enterprise. But ultimately, as in the Cowboys case, the Bronx DA told Adalorado that they could not prosecute because they could not use the uncorroborated testimony of a single witness. The Bronx couldn't protect a witness while he or she gave evidence, either. It would require armed guards at Bronx hotels for up to a year. It looked like the gang would escape prosecution. Glazer heard that the Bronx DA had turned down the case, and she felt it was perfectly suited to her agenda. She called Adalorado and offered to take it federal using RICO. A federal racketeering indictment charged 17 members of C&C, many of whom flipped, some giving up as many as 8 homicides. Within a month, the Willis Avenue lynch mob filled the vacuum left by C&C, so Adalorado and Glazer indicted them federally, too. Afterward, no murders took place during the months of September and November 1994. The success of the RICO laws with the CNC crew drew national attention and a front-page story in the New York Times. The detectives in the 40th Precinct were delighted. The FBI was involved with the mob, but no one wanted to do anything with drug gangs because they were centered in poor communities, Lieutenant Michael Bramble told the Times. You're not talking about Damon Runyon characters dressed in $1,000 suits and driving limousines. You're talking about homegrown thugs preying on their own neighbors. It was a triumph for Glazer and reinforced her conviction that she would need someone working alongside the feds who could navigate the insular world of the NYPD. She needed someone who could flip cooperators and retain the trust of notoriously suspicious and cliquish detectives in the Bronx precincts. Glazer needed John O'Malley. He could move easily in the precincts. Detectives might come to him with their cases because they trusted him, and she knew that she could trust him, too. She called him and made the offer. O'Malley was hesitant. He loved the NYPD and didn't see himself leaving after 20 years with the department. He had hoped to make it to 35 years on the job, retire, and open a hot dog stand in his hometown to be called Diggity Dog. Glazer said he'd work 9 to 5 and get a federal car and an increase in salary. O'Malley said he'd think about it. The last thing on O'Malley's mind was joining the feds. On summer Saturdays, O'Malley and his two young sons swam at the town pool and barbecued, but at 2:30 p.m. sharp, O'Malley kissed them goodbye to head to work, usually to murder scenes and the frantic pace of Bronx homicide. He was beginning to miss all their Little League games. If he took Glazer's offer, he'd get weekends off to spend with his family, but at the same time, he'd be the one guy in the feds working these cases. The sober world of federal law enforcement in the Southern District would be quite different from Bronx homicide. Glazer wanted him to take on the gangs in the Bronx and stop the killing. 7. The Murder Game. Sex money murders' rise came at the cost of Pete's increasing volatility. He took any challenge personally. Pipe, as loyal as ever to his adoptive family, had the words, "No fear," tattooed on his right bicep, above a grim reaper holding back a rearing pit bull on a leash. Sometime on an early spring evening in 1994, the crew headed to the Skate Key, a roller disco on Allerton Avenue with color-flecked carpets, mirror balls, and a history of fights. The venue was thronged with kids skating to Donna Summer and Chic's La Freak. Pete caught sight of a lofty character of 6'5" he had played basketball with at Stevenson High. Carlton Hines, 23 years old, stood draped in a fur coat, surrounded by 15 members of his gang and a group of adoring girls. Pete went over to him, Pipe and the others following. "Remember me?" he asked Carlton. "We used to play basketball together." Hines frowned down at him. "Who the fuck are you?" They exchanged words. Pete punched Carlton in the mouth, and others jumped in. Pipe found himself jostling with one of Carlton's crew. Then Twin and Bear joined the melee, and the bouncers descended, ejecting the four members of Sex Money Murder. Pete and the others went to their cars and pulled guns from the stash boxes, but stowed them when police cars showed up. A beef had just ignited between two of the biggest drug-dealing crews in the Bronx. Hines was a basketball star who ruled the hardscrabble courts in the South Bronx. His cracked front tooth, from a tumble taken on a court in the projects, was unmistakable. For his signature dunk, he'd rocket from the floor, dwarfing the basket before he slammed the ball through the hoop. It earned him a sobriquet that became legend across the Bronx. Duncan Hines. Ever since he was in the 8th grade, newspapers had written stories about the boy in a man's body from the tough Melrose houses, said to be NBA material. Coaches from 35 colleges around the nation risked a foray into the Bronx projects to cultivate Carlton. Often he begged his mother to tell them that he wasn't home. Carlton dreamed of playing for Syracuse, so when he was offered a year at the Maine Central Institute, MCI, to get his grades up so he'd be eligible for a Syracuse scholarship, he took it. But Carlton loathed the solitude of Maine, a world away from the vibrant street life of the Bronx. He wrote his mother a letter and drew a frowning face. Not mad, not happy, he scrawled in the margin. He fell in with Tim Lavin, raised in rural Maine, the son of a wealthy industrial titan. Tim was fascinated with the pounding urgency of the inner city, black life, and emergent rap, all personified by the raffish and towering figure of Carlton. Tim's dad took his son and his new friend to a lobster lunch and then back to the family home. Carlton's jaw dropped in amazement at the swimming pool, the Jaguar, the collection of hunting rifles. Tim sensed that Carlton drew a parallel between his dad's entrepreneurial trappings and those of a Bronx drug dealer. A few weeks later, Carlton schooled Tim in how the Gangsta Creed worked when they were walking to the store together and some white kids harassed them. One of them, an MCI kitchen worker, shouted "nigger" at Carlton. Immediately, Tim suggested that they go over and deal with it, but Carlton demurred, pointing out that he and Tim had no idea if the kids had knives. Instead, he memorized the MCI employee's face and stormed back to the dorm in a rage. The next day, at lunch, Carlton strolled over to the kitchen worker and said, "Remember me?" Carlton punched him so hard that he lifted him off his feet and knocked him out. The entire school rose in the commotion as Tim rushed between them and kitchen staff helped the employee up. But instead of going back to the dorms, as Tim assumed, Carlton entered the kitchen from the loading dock and once more moved up on the injured man, who was holding an ice pack to his face while four other workers held him up. Carlton smashed him in the face again. "Don't you ever," he sneered, "call me a nigger again." When Tim was dumped by his girlfriend and Carlton came upon him sobbing to the strains of U2's "Where the Streets Have No Name," Tim hurriedly turned off the song in embarrassment, not wanting to look weak in front of his friend. Carlton sat beside him, told him to turn it on again, and offered comfort through Tim's tears. When Tim stayed with Carlton in the Bronx, he found a clamorous and intoxicating reality, the opposite of rural Maine. Carlton acted as Tim's protector, a giant sentinel in a raw and dangerous world. They hung out on the streets all night, drinking malt liquor and throwing the bottles in the air, watching them explode into shards in the middle of Cortland Avenue before falling asleep on car hoods. Once they stole a BMW 735i from a parking garage, and Tim found himself offering to drive it up to Maine where it could be stashed, because no one would suspect a white boy. Tim grew close to Carlton's mom, Miss Fay, who called him her white son. Somehow, she managed to care for her five sons on the meager income of a cafeteria worker at St. Luke's Hospital, sleeping on the sofa in the family's Melrose apartment while the young men took the bedrooms. Back in Maine, Carlton's basketball coach sensed that he was uneasy. The emotional and psychological distance between the two worlds was too great. One night, in defiance of dorm rules, Carlton spent hours on the telephone home to the Bronx after lights out. He was disciplined, and the housemaster told him to leave if he could not abide by the regulations. He took his cue and raced back to New York in his Jeep, never to return. He was expelled shortly thereafter. Tim and his family wanted him to come back. Mr. Lavin said he'd put in a good word for him and even offered to pay his tuition. And they said Aisha, the mother of Carlton's daughter, could live in their mansion in Bangor to be near Carlton while he finished school. Carlton thanked them, but rejected their offer. Back in New York, he took to playing basketball in Rucker Park in Harlem, where the courts were concealed in a small arbor of trees overshadowed by the Polo Grounds projects and bounded by Frederick Douglass Boulevard and the Harlem River Drive. In the late 1980s, neighborhoods all over the five boroughs fielded basketball teams comprised of local talent that were often either coached or economically supported by drug dealers and rappers. They paid local hotshots $5,000 or so a game, but bet tens of thousands, often more, with rival dealers on the outcome of prearranged matchups. Away from Maine, Carlton was king once more amid these competing teams. Through the Rucker games, Carlton became familiar with every major drug dealer in the city. As his connections developed, he asked them for cocaine, which he sold sitting on a crate from 7 a.m. until 1 p.m. He got a new name, C-Town, to go with his new drug-dealing status. He drafted other kids in the neighborhood to his crew. A friend named Tony became Trigger Tone. When Tim visited his old friend in the summer of 1989, he found him deep in the drug game, working with his two brothers. One morning, at around 9, pandemonium broke out after Carlton killed a former boxer, Tweety, with a broken bottle. The killing grew out of an argument over a drug debt. Carlton ordered his brothers to hustle Tim out of town, stuffing a fistful of money into his friend's hand, telling him he feared Tweety's allies might go after the white kid always by his side. He went on the run for 11 days, holing up at the Concourse Plaza Hotel, before turning himself in. A grand jury heard testimony and refused to indict, ruling that Carlton had killed in self-defense. With his first body bestowing a more powerful reputation, Carlton upped his commitment to the drug game. He got a Range Rover and put it in his mother's name, which she discovered when a court summons arrived for unpaid parking tickets. Frustrated at Carlton's deceit and dismayed at his dealing, she found a shoebox of money in his closet and started to march to the police station with it. Carlton chased her through the projects. "Ma, you'll get everyone killed if you hand that in," he said, intercepting her. "It's not my money." She lectured him sternly, but returned it. In 1991, Tim, now stationed with the Army in Iraq fighting in Operation Desert Storm, began receiving letters from Carlton. While Tim wore a bulletproof vest and towed an M16 in the desert, Carlton donned a bulletproof vest and carried a weapon for his drug business in the high-rises of the Bronx. Carlton said he sat on the block smoking weed and hustling while listening to the notorious B.I.G. His friend, reading his letters in army camp, fretted that Carlton was getting fat and out of shape. Basketball, a long-distant memory. When Tim got out of the military, he went to see Carlton in New York and found that his old friend surrounded himself with an armed crew in bulletproof vests all the time. Carlton kept Tim away from the drug business in an attempt to build a space for their friendship, but the difference between them was stark. Tim was a reminder of his old life and promise and what he might have been. By 1993, Carlton controlled all corners of the Melrose Projects, which netted him $40,000 a day from both heroin and crack. As his connections in the drug world expanded, he befriended one of Sex Money Murder's major suppliers, John Castro. The Dominican trafficker took a liking to the enterprising young basketball star-turned-drug dealer and planned to one day bring him into the rapidly expanding Sex Money Murder crew. Deep down, Carlton missed basketball. When he returned to play a game for the Gauchos, a South Bronx team, friends from the neighborhood filled the gym as Carlton electrified them once more. He mulled a return to basketball, but he was a gangster now and needed to project an image of menace to keep himself safe. He was stuck until a coach said he'd be paid $1 million a year by the West Stallions, who were holding tryouts April 12, 1994. He began to get back in shape for his comeback and a chance to leave the drug game behind. And then he ran into Sex Money Murder at the roller rink. Pete was intent on killing Hines. The man had disrespected him and had to die. He felt that killing a high-profile dealer would boost his fame. Pipe didn't think the murder was worth the trouble. Everyone knew that Duncan Hines was a star basketball player, but he'd never, in Pipe's eyes, made a reputation as a serious gangster. Maybe Pete wanted to take over the Melrose Projects, but to him the whole thing seemed somewhat arbitrary and futile. Mixed messages came through from Melrose. On one hand, Pipe heard that Carlton wasn't afraid and would do what was necessary to defend himself. Another source said he wanted it known that he apologized, that he hadn't realized he was talking to Pistol Pete. Pete dispatched Pipe to scout Melrose. He discovered, through cousins who lived in the projects, that Hines and his crew hung out in a barber shop between East 155th and East 156th Streets. Pete drove there and spotted Carlton, but the basketball star evaded him. A few weeks later, Pete was on a date at the Bay Plaza Multiplex when he saw Hines also on a date. Pete told Pipe that he had pursued Hines through the complex with an Uzi, but that once more Hines had eluded him. Hours afterward, Hines appeared at his mother's apartment deeply spooked. He tore through closets while she looked on, demanding to know what he needed so urgently. Finally, he produced a bulletproof vest from the back of a bedroom closet. His mother begged him to remove himself from whatever he was involved in. She began praying for her son at church. At one point, Carlton broke down and sobbed to his brother, "When is this shit gonna be over with?" Around the same time, he called his old friend Tim, now living in Texas and running his own web design company. He told Tim about the beef with Pistol Pete and Sex Money Murder, and said he needed to get out of town immediately. "Carlton, you tell me what you want me to do, and I'm there," said Tim. "You want me to drive up there and get you, I'll do it. If you want me to fly out, I'll pick you up, you name it." Tim said that they could work out together, get Carlton back in shape, just like the old days. The call seemed to give new life to their friendship. Carlton said he'd think about it. "The drug game ain't fun anymore," he said shortly before hanging up. A few weeks later, at around 1:30 p.m. on April 4, 1994, Mrs. Hines straightened her hair in the mirror and applied lipstick before heading to work. She caught sight of Carlton outside their building, dressed in unlaced Timberland boots, a silver and black belt, and a T-shirt with a giant marijuana leaf that bore the legend, "Dr. Dre, the Chronic." He wore a diamond-encrusted Rolex. She called down to him. "Hey, you can't come up here to say hi to your favorite girl?" He was busy, so she got her boyfriend to drive her to work. Carlton had other things on his mind. The crew was throwing a block party for two members, Trigger Tone and Samuel B.O. Barnes. Carlton and three of the crew, Tone, Carlos, and Rick, drove to a car detailing shop at 2811 Boston Road, where Carlton had dropped off his Lexus to have chrome rims installed. The garage sat a mile or two east of the Bronx Zoo on a long, monotonous arterial road leading northeast to New Rochelle. When they heard that the car wasn't ready, Rick, a slightly built man with a flat-top fade, urged them to leave. Waiting around in the open could invite scrutiny, and as the dispute with Sex Money Murder escalated, they weren't sure who might come after them next. Just as they were about to leave, though, a salesman suddenly went into a sales pitch for a car alarm. Carlton went back in to have a look. Pete was slapboxing with Pipe on the block in front of the crew, his hands quickly overwhelming Pipe before the younger boy retaliated with one or two slaps of his own. "Skippy got you, Mo," someone laughed, as Pete absorbed the stinging slaps. At that, Pete grappled Pipe into a crushing headlock that had him huffing, his face red with exertion, as six or seven others whooped at the horseplay. Suddenly, Pete's beeper went off with a message from Cod. Pete went to a phone and called back. Cod told him that he had received a call from an associate who worked at a garage on Boston Road. "Tell Smiley that his man is here," was the message Cod's contact passed on to Pete, meaning Hines was at the garage. "Stall him," said Cod to the man in the garage. "Keep him there as long as you can." In response, the man had come up with the car alarm pitch. Minutes later, Cod pulled up outside 551 in his Toyota Land Cruiser. Pete's mood abruptly changed from juvenile to mortally serious as he climbed into the passenger seat and slipped into a black and yellow hoodie that bore the name Grambling State and tugged on a Pittsburgh Steelers baseball hat. Then he pulled on some black leather gloves. Tone and Carlos showed their frustration as Carlton went back in with the salesman. Rick moved off to look at a BMW he liked, while Carlos accompanied Carlton. Suddenly, Carlos found himself facing a gunman who appeared out of thin air with a pistol pointed at the back of Carlton's head. "Carlton, watch your back!" Carlos shouted as he tried to push his friend out of the line of fire. A series of shots from a 9mm handgun rang out. Carlton tumbled to the ground. Then the killer turned the gun on Carlos. He hit him in the leg, but the next two rounds missed as he made his escape. The gunman returned his attention briefly to Hines, pumping more bullets into him, before vanishing like an apparition. Tone raced over and struggled vainly to lift Hines's 200-pound body into their car. "Let's snatch this nigga up and get him to the hospital," he screamed. But then he saw that Carlton's left eye was half closed, his right fully open, gazing upward at a world he no longer belonged to. Carlton was gone. Tone burst into sobs. Rick stood there, slack-jawed. Tone, realizing it was useless, broke down in tears. Police sirens wailed in the distance. They took off in the car, leaving Carlton's body face up, head nearest the road, runnels of blood flowing.